Hello, listeners, and welcome to Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 2nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Looking at today's weather forecast from KCRG, isolated showers will continue moving northeast earlier this morning as a warm front moves up and across eastern Iowa. Much of this activity should be out of here by 9 a.m. Look for highs to push well into the 80s today, with some lower 90s by late afternoon. Tonight, a cold front moves into the area with a chance of storms. As of right now, the chance of anything strong or severe appears to be low. Going into tomorrow, plan on more clouds around with cooler highs around 80. There may be an isolated shower that pops up in the afternoon, and if so, impacts will stay very low. Look for a nice one on Sunday, with highs in the upper 70s. Let's go to the front page now and see what we have for articles to read. They include challenges to voters' registrations skyrocketing, GOP hopefuls soften tone on abortion for midterms, and Crystal Project nearly done. Let's begin reading the story of Vivacious Violinist. Violinist marks 20 years with WCFSO. Story was written by Saul Sapiro. Dateline, Cedar Falls. Meet Carla Lockhart, first violin for the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra. She may sit a lot, but is rarely still. Lockhart has played violin since age 3 and a half, when her mother, Kathy Keitel, enrolled her in a University of Northern Iowa Suzuki class. A perennial all-stater at Cedar Falls High, she joined the WCFSO as a junior in 2002. Her 20th anniversary with the orchestra coincides with that of the conductor and artistic director, Jason Weinberger. As a WCFSO rookie, Lockhart recalled, quote, "Everybody was so supportive and made me feel like one of them. I never felt like I was just the kid. I was always placed with a mentor who answered my questions and made me more comfortable," unquote. In the ensuing years, she earned a UNI music degree, founded the thriving Cedar Valley Strings, performed with various Iowa orchestras and at churches, and has a full roster of violin students. She and husband Scott also are raising 5 children, ages 2 to 14. Quote, "I love the constantly positive energy Cara brings to everything she does in music, including the symphony," Weinberger said. Quote, "That made her a hugely successful businesswoman with Cedar Valley Strings, and even better colleague since the very first time I worked with her when she was a high school student," unquote. She doesn't get sidetracked. Quote, "I didn't perform a few concerts because they were close to my due dates," Lockhart admitted. "Oh, I missed one for my senior prom," unquote. Quote, "I am really fortunate to have a really great support group," she added. "My husband helps hold down the fort," unquote. She'll do double duty during UCFSO's Labor Day weekend extravaganza Saturday at the Cedar Falls Plaza on State Street and 2nd Avenue. Lockhart will join the local duo of Jim Miller and Dave Christofferson and others backing up CFHS musical prodigy Carter Goose at 4:30 p.m., then take the stage again with the WCFSO at 7 o'clock p.m. Playing violin was in her DNA. Her great-grandfather made them. Her grandfather was a self-taught barn dance fiddler, and her mother played. But Lockhart turned her talent into a vocation. The Cedar Valley Strings exceeded 250 engagements prior to this year, when it booked 27 weddings and other events. Violinist Sally Malcolm, her colleague in the WCFSO Cedar Valley Strings, and the Wartburg Symphony Orchestra remarked, quote, "I honestly don't know how she keeps her energy level up. Part of it has to be her commitment to excellence. She wants to do a great job, so she just does whatever it takes. Part of it is probably what keeps all musicians going, a passion for music," unquote. Lockhart doesn't stand pat. Quote, "This year, she's expanded our repertoire based on what people want to hear," Malcolm said. "We no longer just play the classics, but everything from Billy Joel to Guns N' Roses. That has made us much more remarkable, and as a musician, the chance to learn new styles and repertoire is exciting and fun. Lockard has had her fair share of excitement in her young career. With the WCFO, she has played with the likes of Yo-Yo Ma, who was so gracious, quote, he would pull you aside and say, let's take a selfie. In Mannheim Steamroller, becoming friends with some members via social media and sharing family photos. Quote, I feel very blessed to have had the opportunities I've had, Lockhart said. Quote, music has been a lot of hard work, but it was always a priority. I've been fortunate to know some wonderful people along the way, unquote. Next, Crystal Cold. Expansion is nearly complete at former Waterloo Wrath site. Story filed by Andy Malone. Dateline Waterloo. Early next year, Crystal Cold anticipates transitioning into a newly expanded, state-of-the-art refrigerated warehouse in the former Wrath Packing Company area on Sycamore Street. According to a company announcement Thursday, the $21 million project could mean the food registration, storage, and operation will create up to 75 new jobs. Quote, there's a lack of refrigeration around the Midwest, said owner-president Tom Poe. The construction is expensive. Our customers can avoid having to invest in a brick and mortar, and they can get access to our services and labor. As a result, they can instead focus on what they do best. The company, former known as Crystal Distribution Services, caters to businesses ranging from small operations like family-owned grocery stores to large international food companies like meat packing or dairy operation. Crystal Distribution Services purchased and renovated many of the former Wrath buildings into a warehouse space after the meat packer went bankrupt in 1985. Wrath was one of the city's largest employers. The latest project at 1656 Sycamore Street has been in the works for several years and will double Crystal's footprint there to some 220,000 square feet, said Poe. The actual expansion includes 100,000 square feet of food-grade refrigerated space and 25,000 square feet of processing room, along with new freezer, cooler, defrost, and office welfare space. This project puts the company on one level at the corner of Sycamore and Vinton Streets and allows it to close its less-than-ideal multi-story building next door at 1435 Sycamore Street. Quote, we love the location and being in Waterloo, Poe said. We've gotten lots of support from the city, and Noel Anderson, Community Planning and Development Director. People can live in the Cedar Valley and don't have to travel too far for work. Quote, we're proud to be here and are excited to be under one roof. It will be more efficient, he added. Quote, the space will be nicer, state-of-the-art, and will allow us to better offer our services. We're really pumped up about it, unquote. The city bought the building at 1435 Sycamore Street, according to Poe. The next story was filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Challenges to voters' registrations skyrocket in Black Hawk County. Dateline Des Moines. Hundreds of voters' registrations have been challenged in at least two of Iowa's most populated counties this week. Numbers, locals officials said, are extraordinarily higher than usual. Iowans are able by state law to challenge voter registration information if they believe the information is incorrect or fraudulent. Local election officials said they typically receive roughly a handful of challenges to voter registrations each election cycle. But this week, one individual challenged 570 voters' registration information in Black Hawk County. In Linn County, another 119 voters' registration information were challenged, according to local elections officials. Joel Miller said in his 15-plus years as Linn County Auditor, the office has received a total of 3 voter registration challenges prior to the 119 that were filed this week. Black Hawk County Auditor Grant Veder said the office has infrequently received voter registration challenges in the past, but probably never more than 10 at a time. Veder and Miller said the challenged registrations mostly belong to recent Iowa voters whose status has been moved to inactive, meaning they likely did not vote in the 2020 election. In Blackhawk County, all but two of the 570 challenged registrations were to voters whose status was inactive, officials there said. Miller said it appears that a majority of the registrations that have been challenged belong to voters who have moved out of state, and many of the challenged registrations may have been canceled after this fall's election anyway, Veder said. In Iowa, a voter's registration is canceled when an individual does not vote in two consecutive elections. Among those 570 challenges in Blackhawk County, 324 would be canceled early next year if those individuals do not vote in November. Elections officials in Polk and Woodbury counties did not respond to requests for information Thursday. Scott County Auditor Carrie Tompkins said her office has not received any voter registration challenges. Miller said the exponentially higher than usual number of voter registration challenges may have been inspired by a recent speaker in Iowa who, without evidence, questions the accuracy of the 2020 presidential election results and encourages individuals to flood local election officials with voter registration challenges. The liberal political news site Iowa Starting Line recently reported on Douglas Frank's remarks, July 27th in Independence, to a group called Iowa Canvassing, which on its website builds itself as a grassroots group of volunteers keeping Iowa voter rolls clean for fair and trusted elections, unquote. Iowa Canvassing did not respond to requests for comment. The Courier will update the story if the group responds. Frank is a former math teacher from Ohio who travels the country speaking to groups about election fraud. In his remarks to Iowa Canvassing, he made the widely disproved accusation that there has been, quote, massive election fraud, unquote. He invoked a conspiracy theory involving Jewish billionaire philanthropist George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. According to Iowa Starting Line, dozens of court challenges and dozens of state elections officials have investigated and found no measurable voter fraud in the 2020 presidential election. Former President Donald Trump continues to make claims to the contrary without evidence. State law requires the opportunity for a 10-minute hearing for any voter whose registration has been challenged. Miller and Veder both said because it appears most of the challenges are to inactive voters, including many who appear to have left the state, they do not expect many hearings to take place. Both said they are planning for a limited number of hearings and will adjust their schedules if needed. The voter registration challenges create an extra duty for local elections officials just as they are preparing for the November 8th elections, Miller and Veder said. Quote, receiving this volume of challenges is not something we would prefer to address when we are getting very busy with an upcoming general election, especially when all of the voters involved have already been given inactive status. And many of them will have their voter registrations canceled after the November 8 election, Veder wrote in an email. A spokesman for the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Pate, the state's top elections official, acknowledged an unusually high number of voter registration challenges and expressed faith in county auditors to handle the challenges as prescribed by state law. Quote, we trust that the county auditors, in consultation with their county attorneys, will work to thoroughly review each challenge and make a determination of the challenged voters' qualifications in accordance with Iowa law, Iowa Secretary of State spokesman Kevin Hall said in an email. Hall also pointed Iowa voters to sections on the Iowa Secretary of State website that address myths and misinformation about elections. Any Iowa voter, regardless of their registration status, can register to vote at any time, including on Election Day at the polls. Our next article comes from the Associated Press journalist Thomas Beaumont, Dateline Des Moines. During a primary debate in May, Iowa Republican Zach Nunn and his two rivals were asked to raise their hand if they thought all abortions should be illegal. Quote, "All abortions, no exceptions," the moderator clarified. Nunn's left hand went up. The image has shadowed the Iowa state senator as he seeks to unseat U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, one of the most vulnerable House Democrats this election season. The two-term congresswoman has featured video of Nunn from the debate in TV ads she's been running since early August. Nunn is among well more than a dozen strictly anti-abortion Republicans running in competitive House, Senate, and governor's races this fall in Minnesota, Nevada, Kansas, Arizona, and elsewhere, who are trying to distance themselves from their past statements. In newspaper op-eds, during interviews, and on their campaign websites, Republican challengers who express support for banning most or all abortions, some in cases of rape, incest, and to protect the life and health of the mother, are at a minimum downplaying those positions and at most backtracking at a time when abortion rights have complicated Republicans' focus on the economy heading into the November midterm elections. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in June overturning Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision recognizing a federal right to abortion, has prompted a backlash from abortion rights supporters and shined a light on politicians whose anti-abortion positions were only hypothetical when Roe was the law of the land. Quote, "I think that the bait and switch will matter for those for whom abortion rights is a very important voting issue, which is an expanded group since Roe was overturned," Christine Matthews, a pollster who has worked for Republicans, said of GOP candidates trying to soften their profile on the issue. Quote, "And it may matter to a wider group if it appears that they are deceptive," unquote. Accusing Axne of misrepresenting his position, Nunn wrote in an op-ed published in the Des Moines Register last month that he supported exceptions for rape, incest, and the life and health of the mother when he voted in 2018 for a ban on abortions after 6 weeks, a measure that was blocked by the courts. Asked in an Associated Press interview why he raised his hand to the no exceptions question during the debate, Nunn misstated the question as, quote, "Do you support life?" unquote, instead of the actual wording, which was, quote, "In your mind, should all abortions be illegal in this country? Hand up if you say yes," unquote. Quote, "Let me be perfectly clear. I believe life begins at conception," Nunn said in the interview. "I recognize the viability of a child. I recognize the health of the mother." Still, in 2017, Nunn voted for a measure requiring women seeking an abortion to wait 72 hours, which included an exception to protect the life of the mother, but made no mention of rape or incest. In Kansas, Republican Amanda Adkins, who is running against two-term Democratic Representative Charisse Davis, wrote in a Kansas City Star op-ed published last week, quote, "I don't support a federal ban on abortion," unquote. The mention came after months of silence by Adkins after the May leak of a draft Supreme Court opinion signaling Roe was in jeopardy. A decade earlier, as Kansas's Republican chair, Adkins had supported a strict abortion ban on the party's platform. Adkins's star piece also followed close on the heels of Kansas voters' decisive rejection of a constitutional amendment that would have nullified a state Supreme Court decision guaranteeing the right to an abortion. Notably, the referendum failed in Johnson County, a teeming suburban heart of Davis's district, by more than 2-1. Adkins publicly supported the amendment. Nunn's and Adkins efforts to de-emphasize their previous conservative stances on abortion are conspicuous. Others have been more subtle. In a Northwest Indiana district that includes working-class cities outside Chicago, Republican Jennifer Ruth Green answered, quote, none, in a 2022 online questionnaire before the Supreme Court overturned Roe that asked under what circumstances should abortion be allowed. Yet, as the GOP nominee facing Democratic Republican Frank Marvin, Green says she supports an anti-abortion measure passed by the Indiana legislature in August that includes exceptions for rape, incest, and the health of the mother. In suburban Minneapolis, Republican Tyler Kushner, who lost narrowly to two-term Democratic Representative Angie Craig in 2020, is challenging her again. In 2020, his website included a section on abortion that stated he wanted to eliminate federal funding for Planned Parenthood. In this year's campaign, his website does not mention abortion. Republicans running statewide in battleground races have undertaken similar efforts. Arizona Senate candidate Blake Masters called abortion demonic during the GOP primary and called for a federal personhood law that would give fetuses the rights of people. He toned down his rhetoric more recently, deleting references to a personhood law from his campaign website and dropping language describing himself as 100% pro-life. In Nevada, where a 1990 referendum guarantees the right to abortion, Republican gubernatorial candidate Joe Lombardo said during a May primary debate that he would consider signing a ban on the Plan B pill. The pill, which is different from the abortion pill, can significantly lower the chance of pregnancy if taken within 72 hours of unprotected sex. But in late July, a month after Dobbs' decision, Lombardo's campaign said he had no plans to ban contraception. In August, after Justice Clarence Thomas indicated in the Roe reversal that other high court rulings, including ones protecting the use of contraceptives, should also be reconsidered, Lombardo said he would not block contraceptives and has since noted on his website that he would, quote, ensure that contraceptives stay accessible to Nevadans, unquote. In the immediate aftermath of the Dobbs v. Mississippi decision overturning Roe, an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll showed 22% of U.S. adults named abortion or women's rights in an open-ended question as one of up to five problems they wanted the government to address. That's more than doubled since December, when an AP NORC poll found a notable uptick in mentions of abortion from years before, likely in anticipation of the Dobbs ruling. In Iowa, 60% of adults say abortion should be legal in most or all cases, according to a Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll taken in July, higher still in the suburbs. That would seem to be a consideration for Nunn, running in Iowa's 3rd congressional district, which includes the metro area surrounding the capital, Des Moines, and its booming suburbs to the north and west, as well as vast tracts of more conservative rural southwestern Iowa. While it's a small group on both sides, it energizes them because it's an important issue, Nunn said, adding that Axne is not even willing to have a conversation about where she's been on this, unquote. The counterpunch is a veiled reference to bills, including one passed in July in the Democratic-controlled House with Axne's support, that block limits on abortions late in a pregnancy, a position Republicans have characterized as extreme. Republican pollster Whit Ayres said Dobbs has reversed earlier Republican momentum by increasing enthusiasm among abortion rights advocates. Clearly, there's been movement in the Democrats' favor, said Ayres, who is an advisor for a super PAC supporting Florida Senator Marco Rubio's campaign. quote, the Dobbs decision gave them a reason to get engaged, and that's evident in increased Democratic enthusiasm, unquote. We turn the page now to the Cedar Valley section. Trinity Health completes acquisition of Mercy One Health System. Story filed by Andrew Wind. Livonia, Michigan. Trinity Health, one of the nation's largest not-for-profit Catholic health systems, announced Thursday the agreement to acquire Mercy One is completed. Mercy One is now a full member of the Trinity Health System, based in Livonia, Michigan. The news follows an April announcement that Trinity Health signed an agreement with Common Spirit Health to acquire all facilities and assets of Iowa-based Mercy One, including home care, hospice, and infusion locations. Quote, for close to 25 years, we have served Iowa communities. With Mercy One now fully part of Trinity Health, we are a stronger and more unified system that will strengthen Mercy One's ability to serve our patients, colleagues, and communities, said Mike Slabowski, President and Chief Executive Officer of Trinity Health. Quote, healthcare providers across the country continue to face unprecedented challenges brought on by the COVID pandemic, but together we are stronger. With our shared history and Catholic mission, we look forward to continuing a legacy of high-quality care for generations to come, unquote. The completion of the acquisition is a highly anticipated milestone that marks a shared commitment to ensuring access to health care across Iowa. Operating as a part of Trinity Health, Mercy One will retain its name and brand while enhancing more integrated and unified care in the communities it serves. Today's closing further advances Mercy One's vision to provide a personalized and radically convenient care experience for Iowans and neighboring communities. We are delighted to become a full member of the Trinity Health family, which will further our goal to be a more strongly connected system of health services, said Bob Ritz, President and Chief Executive Officer at Mercy One. Quote, we are grateful to Common Spirit for their support in the transition and for more than 25 years of successful partnership in Iowa. We look forward to further strengthening the mission of Mercy One, unquote. Mercy One serves more than 3.3 million patients each year. It consists of 16 medical centers, including hospitals in Waterloo and Cedar Falls, that were part of Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare before 2016. There are also 27 wellness offerings, such as provider services and urgent care. More than 20,000 people are employed by the system, 2,000 of those doctors and providers. Trinity Health facilities span 25 states. Since 1998, the Iowa-based regional health system has been under a joint operating agreement between Trinity Health and Catholic Health Initiatives, which is now Common Spirit. And now, listeners, we want to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 2nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Darlis Inez Fram Varner, 92, longtime resident of Waterloo, passed away into the arms of the Lord on August 4th at her son's home in Trophy Club, Texas. Darlis was born in rural Bremer County, raised on the family farm, attended a one-room schoolhouse, and graduated from Sumner High School in 1947. Upon graduation, she moved to Waterloo, soon securing an administrative job at Rath Packing Company, where she worked for 12 years before resigning to devote her full-time energy to raising her four children. Darlis met her husband, Bill, at Electric Park Ballroom and married him in 1952. Darlis later took a job at St. Francis Hospital, Covenant Medical Center, where she worked nights so she could be home with the children during the day, until her retirement in 2000. She always wanted the best for her family, ready with a helping hand, even into her 90s. She was a proud member of the First Presbyterian Church for over 70 years and considered the church an important part of her life. The first story she always told was her dad calling, "Darls, come hold this tape measure," and her running outside to help while her sisters stayed inside. She loved being the tomboy. The second story she'd proudly told was about getting second place in the high school singing contest, later all the parents and teachers saying she should have won. When she was 12, she drove her dad's Ford to school, picking up other children along the way. She loved horses, especially the family horse Maud, and always had stories about the two beloved draft horses, Barney and Sailor. Darls loved music. She was part of the Waterloo Mother's Choir and Church Choir. When a child, she always wanted to play the piano, but as a farm girl, never had the time. All the way to the end, she loved dancing around the house to the sounds of country music. Now in heaven, perhaps, she is playing the piano and singing "I'll Fly Away" and "Amazing Grace." Darls is survived by her children, Mark, wife Sandy, of Green Bay, Wisconsin, Randy, wife Diana, of Trophy Club, Texas, Philip, wife Sherry, of St. Charles, Missouri, and Kristen, husband Patrick, of Davidsonville, Maryland. Her younger sister, Marianne Richards, 11 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. Darles was preceded in death by her husband, 2 brothers, and 2 sisters. Funeral services will be held at Parrot and Wood Chapel of Memories in Waterloo on October 8th at 11:30 a.m. Next, in Independence, longtime Independence, Iowa resident Evelyn Julia Hoover, 92, passed away Tuesday, August 30th, 2022, at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Living Center in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Evelyn was born on May 12th, 1930, in rural Winthrop, Iowa, the daughter of George Washington and Julia May, maiden name Fest, Frank. She attended Newtonville and Quasqueton schools, graduating from Independence High School. At age 17, she started working at People's Memorial Hospital as a nurse's aide, and later worked for Northwestern Bell as a telephone operator. On June 4, 1950, Evelyn married Charles Raymond Hoover at the Kinney Congregational Church in Newton Township, Buchanan County. Together, they made their home in Independence, where they raised their 3 children. Evelyn loved to travel and enjoyed sharing her adventures with others so much that she became a travel agent. She owned and operated Hoover Travel and Tour for many years. She had group tours throughout Europe, South America, and North America. She is survived by a daughter, Tamela, spouse Alan Pink of Cedar Rapids, a son, James, spouse Sharifa Hoover of Vancouver, Washington, her grandson, Barry Charles, spouse Katie Hoover of Independence, and her great-grandchildren, Dalton Charles and Blake Ryan Hoover. Evelyn was preceded in death by her husband, Charles, in 2008 at age 85, a son, Charles Craig Hoover, in 2020, her father, C.W. Frank, her mother and stepfather, Julia and Lou Walters, and her 12 siblings, Benjamin George Frank, Gilbert Frank, Leon Frank, Irma Short, Marjorie Toomey, Bernice Short, Geneva Gaffney, George Frank, Burley Frank, Dorothea Fremo, Archie Frank, and Betty Lou Frank. A funeral service will be held for Evelyn at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, September 3rd, 2022, at Hoover Wesleyan Church in rural Troy Mills. The burial will be held at Circle Grove Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour before the service on Saturday. The Rife Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory, is handling the arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Hoover Wesleyan Church. Condolences may be mailed to Tammy in care of the Hoover Wesleyan Church, 2900 310th Street, Walker, Iowa, 52352. To leave an online condolence, please go to www.rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. Here, the courier lists three death notices. Jack R. DeMuth, 75, of Chicago, Illinois, died surrounded Friday, August 26, 2022, at Evanston Hospital, Evanston. Arrangements are with White Funeral Home in Jessup. Thomas R. Greenlee, 82, of Independence, died Monday, August 29, 2022, at ABCM Independence West Campus in Independence. Arrangements are with White Funeral Home. And Stephen Lynn Thomason, 67, of Center Point, formerly Grundy Center, died August 30, 2022, at his home. Arrangements are with Engelkes Abels Funeral Home. Now we turn to the Metro Briefs column. Local Republicans host dinner. Dateline Waterloo. The Black Hawk County Republicans are holding the 2022 Lincoln-Reagan-Trump dinner from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. October 2nd at the Waterloo Elks Club. Speakers will include Jeff Kaufman, the chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, and Leon Mosley, former co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa and former Black Hawk County supervisor. Cost is $60 per reservation. To reserve a seat or make a donation, go to blackhawkgop.org. For more information, contact Wendy Wells at area code 319-404-7308. Free Labor Day concert set. Dateline Cedar Falls. The Cedar Falls Municipal Band, directed by Dennis A. Downs, will present its annual Labor Day Encore Concert at 7 p.m. Monday in Overman Park. The program will feature selections performed by the 44-piece group on earlier concerts. Clarinetist Ethan Samples will perform Fillmore's Lightning Fingers and jazz pianist David Smith with Sean McVicker and Paul Ryder will provide pre-show entertainment at 6:15 p.m. Admission is free. The Cedar Falls Rotary Club operates a popcorn and soft drink concession stand with proceeds supporting the band and other causes. Concert goers are encouraged to bring lawn chairs or blankets for comfort. In case of rain, the concert may be delayed or canceled. For more information, call area code 319-266-1253. Now we turn to the opinion section. This editorial first appeared in the New York Times, and it's written by Farhad Manjoo. The title is, America is Being Consumed by a Moral Panic Over Trans People. And the editorial begins with a photograph of a person holding a pride flag. In Utah last year, the parents of two girls who'd placed second and third during a state-level sporting event got suspicious about the girl who'd handily won first place. Had she always been a girl? At the time, Utah had not yet passed a law barring transgender athletes from participating in school sports under their gender identity. Still, officials received complaints from parents about athletes who didn't look feminine enough. David Spadafore, the legislative representative of the Utah High School Activities Association, recently testified. Officials were only too happy to investigate. In the case of the student who won first place, school administrators tracked down her academic records without informing her or her parents. Quote, the school went back to kindergarten, Sadafor testified, and she'd always been a female, unquote. Phew! Lawmakers elsewhere, though, aren't taking any chances. In June, the Ohio House passed a bill requiring a doctor to examine school children's hormone levels, genetics, or internal and external reproductive anatomy in the event of a dispute over the gender of an athlete participating in women's sports. There is currently only one known transgender athlete at the varsity level in all of Ohio high school sports. And she told a reporter recently, quote, I barely even get to play because I'm not great, unquote. Still, lawmakers called their bill the Save Women Sports Act. This is what a moral panic looks like. Unhinged hysteria sows fear and suspicion by inflating unusual ideas and lifestyles into social and political emergency. Transgender people have long aroused such panic. Have you mustered the courage to enter a public restroom since the great transgender bathroom scare of the mid-2010s? But in the past couple of years, the fears have reached a fever pitch. And in the run-up to the midterms, trans people, trans young people especially, have become a hysterical obsession of the right. 18 states have recently passed transgender athlete bills, and more are in the wings. 4 states have restricted access to gender-affirming care for young people, and more than a dozen are considering restrictions. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott ordered that parents who allow transition-related care for their kids be investigated for child abuse. The state's only clinic for transgender adolescents was forced to shut down. Last month, false claims that Boston Children's Hospital was performing genital surgeries on minors went viral. Boston Children's and several other hospitals that provide transition-related health care services for adolescents were bombarded with threats. This overt fear-mongering has become the latest right-wing phenomenon. Transgender issues are a red meat staple on Fox News and among fringe lawmakers like Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from QAnon, who has proposed a federal ban on transition-related care for minors. But anxiety about trans issues is a concern of not just the far right. Stories about how trans people are changing American life, how their sensibilities capture medical organizations and other institutions, how they're punished for changes in language, how they've engendered a fragile intellectual atmosphere where one wrong opinion can get you canceled, have become a mainstay of discussion. Joe Rogan, who in other contexts talks up his long-term reliance on testosterone replacement therapy, frequently suggests on his podcast that the way transgender people are breaking norms is a sign of civilizations collapsing, unquote. To put this in language that Rogan might understand, dude, come on. The increase in visibility and social acceptance of transgender people is certainly one of the important societal changes of the past decade. I'm not saying that it isn't a topic worthy of reporting, analysis, and debate, and I don't think that everyone who raises these issues is transphobic, but there is also a real danger that politicians and pundits' excessive focus on such societal changes can exaggerate their real-world effects. For instance, is it a little awkward and cringy that many advocates now say things like birthing people instead of women as a way to be inclusive of trans people? Sure. But when an ultra-neologism inspires multiple critical pieces across several outlets, when pundits and celebrities accusing the inclusive language of the erasing of women, that seems to me like it can veer into the realm of pure panic. This sort of fixation imputes to trans people an outsized role in American culture and politics. It pretends that they pose a threat to our institutions, whether women's sports or academic journals or civilization generally. That overstates their place in society beyond all rationality and recognition. So it's worth remembering some stark facts whenever you hear that trans issues are somehow taking over civic life. There are relatively few trans people in America. Many of the controversies you hear about them are unlikely to directly affect the lives of the vast majority of non-trans Americans. Trans people still wield astonishing little power over anything. They still face tremendous difficulties and disadvantages across many areas of life, and mainstream acceptance and equality of transgender people is hardly the certainty that it is often portrayed in punditry. A recent Pew Research survey found that fewer than 0.6% of American adults say they're transgender, and an additional 1% are non-binary. According to Pew, more than half of the American adults don't even know a trans person personally. Trans identification among adults is highest among those under 25, 3.1% of whom say they are transgender man or woman. The Williams Institute, a sexual orientation research group at the UCLA School of Law, also found that young people make up a large share of people who identify as trans. There are about 300,000 transgender people aged 13 to 17 in the United States, accounting for about 18% of the country's transgender population, Williams researchers said. But although there is a debate about whether and how young people should undergo transition-related healthcare therapies, as my colleague and friend Emily Bazelon covered with care and insight recently in the Times magazine, most transitions of young people involve no medical intervention at all. Quote, "For the overwhelming majority of trans youth, what transitioning means, really, social transition." Rodrigo Heng Leitinen, the executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality, told me, quote, "It usually means changing the name that they go by, changing the pronoun, styling their hair differently, and changing how they dress," unquote. Notice the tripwires here. Trans kids trigger the same cultural sensitivities that have always sent American parents into full-on panic, from punk to Ebonics to Bart Simpson. It's all about what young people are wearing, how they're speaking, and whom they look up to. The debate over transgender participation in sports often similarly elides the rarity of the issue. Stories often focus on a handful of athletes, many of them on the swimmer Leah Thomas. That's because there just aren't that many others. The Utah official testified that only about 7 transgender athletes had asked to participate in high school sports statewide last year. When Florida's House voted on a trans athlete ban, the bill, the Fairness in Women's Sports Act, was later signed into law by Governor Ron DeSantis. The Orlando Sentinel sports columnist Mike Bianchi wrote, quote, "I've been covering collegiate sports in this state for 30 years, and I've never covered nor known a sports journalist who covered a transgender athlete competing in girls or women's sports in this state," unquote. A colleague of his had never heard of such a case in high school sports either. Meanwhile, mired as we are in these ginned-up controversies, we don't hear nearly enough about how marginalized trans people really are, or the significant social and economic burdens they still suffer. Compared with cisgender adults, trans people have lower incomes and less access to health care, and suffer more chronic health conditions. A study analyzing private insurance data from 2011 to 2019 found that trans people, quote, were nearly twice as likely to die over the period as their non-trans peers, unquote. The 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey, the largest survey of transgender people conducted in the United States, found that nearly 82% of trans people had seriously thought about suicide, and 40% had attempted it once in their lifetimes, and 60% of Americans, according to a recent Pew survey, believe that a person's gender is determined by the sex they're assigned at birth, and that number has steadily increased since 2017. Remember these stats the next time you hear that trans people have a stranglehold on American public opinion. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our next editorial was written by Maureen Dowd of the New York Times. Her title is "The Day Gorbachev Made D.C. Stand Still," and it begins with a black and white photograph of Mikhail Gorbachev in a big crowd of people right in the center. And this picture was taken right after he ordered his motorcade to stop on the way to the White House in 1987. Dateline Washington. There have been two surreal visitations in Washington that left people quivering with excitement. The first was 7 decades ago, when a spaceship landed on the mall and an alien in a large silver robot got out. Hollywood movie makers had come to do location filming for the 1951 sci-fi classic, The Day the Earth Stood Still, unquote. The second was on December 11, 1987, when Mikhail Gorbachev, on his way to the White House to meet with President Ronald Reagan, suddenly ordered his driver to stop his Zill limousine downtown. He had seen the lunchtime crowd waving at him, and he wanted to jump out and press the flesh. Quote, the door opened, he got out, he walked right over and took my hand, Kimberly Spartan, an account executive, told me, staring at her hand. I'm still shaking. It was like the coming of the second Messiah or something, unquote. By the time his KGB detail realized what was happening, the agents were already way down the block, so I got to see a Soviet motorcade drive backward, one of the highlights of my career. Americans had grown accustomed to and fearful of Soviet leaders like Stalin, who killed millions of people, and outfoxed FDR at Yalta, and Khrushchev, who banged his shoe on the table and outfoxed JFK in Vienna. They were stunned and thrilled to see a smiling Soviet leader on a charm offensive. People were hanging out of windows and leaning over balconies screaming, Gorby. Indeed, Gorbachev had come to Washington for the same reason the alien in The Day the Earth Stood Still did, to pursue peace before our powerful weapons wiped out the planet. The year before, I covered the Reykjavik summit, which was the biggest thing to hit Iceland since Gunnlaug the Serpent Tongue fought for the love of Helga the Fair. The Russians started out persnickety, protesting the presence of a large Top Gun poster across the hotel from their delegation was staying. It was taken down. But talks between Reagan and Gorbachev, held at the allegedly haunted Hofde House on the riverfront, were historic until they dramatically collapsed at the last minute. The two leaders had come within a few words of an agreement about banning all ballistic missiles. I also saw one top reporter misting up at the missed opportunity. They both left bowed. Gorbachev, with his brainy and fashionable wife, Raisa, looking glamorous in a silver fox fur coat and suede stiletto boots. But the failed summit set the stage for a treaty in 1987. It was hard for American leaders to accept the new Soviet openness. Quote, trust but verify, Reagan liked to say. And Soviet leaders were equally suspicious of Reagan's theatrical talk about Star Wars and the evil empire. We didn't know at the time that there was an unseen hand guiding the fate of civilization. In her memoir, Joan Quigley wrote about her 7-year gig as the White House astrologer for the Reagans, paid for by Nancy Reagan. The San Francisco soothsayer, who often appeared on The Merv Griffin Show, took credit for persuading Nancy to change her Aquarian husband's mind about the evil empire, paving the way for Glasnost. We didn't know at the time that there was an unseen hand guiding the fate of civilization. She wrote that the Reagan's defense strategy for the West was possible because of his combination of a Capricorn Mars with his Taurus Saturn, unquote. Quote, Gorbachev would have a natural respect for Reagan because Reagan's Taurus moon, so descriptive of his personality or image, shows him to be a very likable and genial man, but a stubborn one, unquote, she said in the book. Quigley assured the First Lady that the Soviets were not gangsters. Mercury in Aquarius likes ideas, she wrote. Gorbachev's openness to new ideas is phenomenal. She said she used Reagan's location chart to pick Reykjavik as a summit site, and she knew from her charts that a final resolution there would take longer than anyone had planned, unquote. At a news conference in 1988, Reagan had to deny that he was a slave to the Zodiac, although top aides verified that Nancy was relying on the stars to help schedule summits, surgeries, Air Force One takeoffs, and foreign trips. The Soviet motorcade going backwards was a marvel, but that was nothing compared to an astrologer dictating whether America was going forward on a treaty banning intermediate-range nuclear weapons. When Gorbachev came to America in 1987, he met with top New York businessmen, including Malcolm Forbes and Donald Trump. I called Donald Trump to see how the meeting had gone, and he said he was dubious about whether we should trust the Soviets and hoped that the Americans were not overly eager to make a deal with Gorbachev. Quote, in the art of deal-making, he said, you should not want to make the deal too much, unquote. But the Soviets cleverly softened up the self-regarding real estate dealer by telling him that they loved Trump Tower. They invited him to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Maybe, he said, capitalism is right around the corner, unquote. And that, dear reader, is when Trump first rolled over for Russia. And listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 2nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.